Hey everyone, this is Tom. Welcome to episode 12 of The Great Divide, part 3, and the final part of our Bruce Watson trilogy. I mistakenly called this episode 13 at the end of last episode, but this is episode 12, and we're just going to jump right into it as we always do. This is Bruce continuing his discussion about the Big Country official studio releases, and he's going to start talking about Peace in Our Time, and we're going to go all the way up through Driving to Damascus. So hope you enjoy it. Here we go. All right. Well, awesome. So let's move on to Peace in Our Time then. And, yeah. You know, the big album for you guys in a lot of respects. Some don't like it. Some love it. It's kind of one of those albums that.
I'm on my album.
Yeah, exactly.
Some on my album.
Now, let me start by asking you about what led up to the Peace in Our Time album. And that was like these mythical to Big Country fans, REL sessions, because you guys cranked out some just incredible songs, I think, in that period. I've always said that if you would have, you know, taken those songs to a producer and polished them up or whatever, it could have been the best Big Country album ever, at least from my own opinion.
Yeah, well, for once in our career, we had a bit of time and obviously gained a bit of experience and a bit of cash as well to have that luxury where we could take a little bit of time out and go into REL Studios in Edinburgh. I think it's what stands for Radio Edinburgh Limited, I think it is.
Okay.
And we did have a little, we had the luxury of time. In fact, I'm sure we did them quite quick anyway, you know. Everybody was brimming with ideas. Again, that was an album that was more of a group effort. So everyone was brimming with ideas. Got into the studio, and I mean, I don't know how many songs we demoed. Possibly about 15.
Wow.
And it was around the same time we were doing things like Made in Heaven and all that kind of stuff.
Listen now, there's no time to explain. Been here such a short time, I will be here again. If you hear my voice in the darkness, if you hear my words on the rain, don't be afraid, it only says you did not wait in vain.
The studio engineer there was a guy called Beegal, B-E-E-G-Al, Al. He always wore this t-shirt that had Beegal, and he was a lovely guy, a real character, and we got on great with him, you know. And it was one of those things that everything clicked into place, and then we went out to Hollywood.
Exactly.
Off.
Oh, that's kind of what I was getting to. I mean, when you were doing those REL songs, did you feel like these were going to be the new album at the time that you were doing it?
Well, yeah. I mean, we just thought, well, that's it. These are the songs. Obviously, some of the songs got used.
Right.
And there was other new ones that we wrote out there. It's not my favorite album. It's got a few key tracks that I do like. I've got a few other tracks on it that are just, you know, I just thought, well, some of those songs that we wrote back at REL were so much better, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But we were, we got signed to Reprise Records, Mo Austin and Lenny Wank, and we wanted to be good boys. we'd always had sort of troubles with record companies in the past and stuff like that. So we thought, well, this is a new company. You know, let's be good boys. We'll just do everything they say, you know.
How does that process work when you present them with those songs? I mean, for example, like, you know, you're bringing in a song, for example, like Over the Border or Christmas Island or whatever you did in those demos. And do you actually play them for record company people and then they just tell you, we like this, we don't like this? Or is that something that the producer decides?
Nah, it was kind of the producer, Peter Wolf. I love Peter Wolf. He's a great, great guy and he's a great producer. But I just don't think he was the right producer for Big Country.
Yeah.
He had never seen the band live, you know, whereas people like Robin and Steve Lillywhite had obviously, you know, been at shows and stuff like that and knew what the band were about beforehand. But with Peter, we were just a new thing, you know, and he had his ideas about how we should sound and, you know, but we were just good boys and just kind of went along. I found it really weird. I mean, take it for instance, 13 Valleys, which is a song where Stuart plays the guitar at the start, I come in later on with the mandolin. But it's a simple song, and Stuart's just playing, starts off in A. It's like a typical turnaround, simple guitar picking thing that anybody could kind of play. It's not big country sounding, it's just a standard guitar sequence of chords. He got Stuart on that track to record all the strings of the guitar onto the synclavier. And then Peter, that's not Stuart playing on that, that's Peter Wolfe playing the keyboard. That's only Stuart's guitar sampled. It's actually Peter playing it on his piano keys on his synclavier. And then what he did was, he got Stuart to play the part, but not play it, if you see what I mean. He didn't, he just recorded the squeaks of the guitar strings, you know, so, you know, that's just the way it was back then. It was, everyone was after a complete separation. You know, a couple of things I did where they said record a chord into the synclavier, and I think it was the start of Time for Leaving, they had all this backward stuff going down, you know, and...
Yeah, yeah.
Playing individual strings, and then he would just play them on his synclavier, and I enjoyed it. You know, there's not too many, but the end product was, it didn't sound like big country.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it too. There are tons of things I love about Peace in Our Time, but yeah, it from a fan's perspective, it was a bit of a shock, and
yeah, it was too just sounded like a different band.
Yeah,
altogether, but obviously. Peter was going for, again, a bit like Dave Bates, well, he was going for the hit, the radio-friendly thing. And to be honest, the album and the singles just did absolutely nothing in America.
Right.
I think it kind of distanced a lot of fans in the UK and Europe.
From the people that I, you know, were fans along with me, I remember that was the album where some of them said, I don't like this direction, and they kind of faded a little bit. And a couple fans wanted me to ask this, Bruce. And this is something that I was always interested in, too, because when I first heard King of Emotion, I remember hearing that on the radio, and I had no idea it was Big Country.
I'm shocked.
It did. I was in college at the time in America, and they played it, and I didn't know it was Big Country. And the reason that I didn't recognize it was because Stewart's voice sounded so different to me.
Yep.
Did he get some kind of direction to try to lessen his accent or his Scottish inflection? I don't want to say to sing more American, but I mean, it sounded like he was doing that almost.
Yeah, I don't think so. I just think Stuart progressed, you know. I think when you've done so many albums, you obviously, hopefully you get better at your trade. You end up playing guitars. When you did your first albums, your first recordings, a lot of the guitar playing and the vocals are kind of... that is new to you, so you're quite naive and you're trying to find your voice, whether it be your vocals or your guitar. And right. I think after all the experience that Stuart's had, he just fell into that, you know, became more confident with his voice. And I think, obviously, you lose something along the way, you know, but I just think, even in later albums, Stuart's voice is it's a different voice altogether from The Crossing in Steel Town.
Yeah.
Probably sounds more palatable on the radio or whatever, but I don't think Stuart was actually told to sing in a certain way. You couldn't tell Stuart anything, you know?
Right.
Yeah, one of those kind of guys. Somebody could maybe say something or suggest something, and they went out the room and was like, I'm not listening to that crap, you know, I'll do it my way. I don't think he went for any sort of vocal training. He may have done, but I don't think he did.
Lots of fans wondered about that because it happened so distinctly starting with Peace in Our Time. It was like a big change for that album specifically.
Right.
But there you go. I guess it's just one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, anything. I just think as you move on, you kind of, you know, you get better at what you do and you kind of sound a bit more professional or whatever. But you do lose something along the way.
Okay, I just want to go back to the production one more time. I mean, you pretty much said it now as well, but there's also been quotes in the past and comments about whether working with Peter Wolf, whether he was the right man for the job. And I was just wondering, during the recording, did you have any thoughts about the direction? Did it feel right, or was it more realized at the end that, oops, this isn't what we were hoping for?
To be honest, we were, it was kind of a bit like the Ruttles. We were too busy having a good time. We were out in LA for 3 months, you know, and it was, you know, and Peter didn't work the weekends, which ain't the old cash, you know. It's like when you're in a studio, every penny's a prisoner, you know.
But so, so are you saying that LA is more fun than Stockholm?
No. Oh, what?
Keep on.
So it was definitely cheaper. So we had a lot of time on our hands at weekends, and we were sort of tourists, you know, and doing the old, you know, going out and hanging out on the strip and doing that sort of rock and roll thing. But I don't know, what was the question?
The question was more if you realized in hindsight that the album sound wasn't what you set out to do, or whether you had any alarm bells during the process.
Yeah, we just kind of, like I said, we wanted to be good boys, and we went with it and did everything the company said.
Right.
Looking back, it was, you know, we could have stopped at any time, but we were kind of caught up in the whole LA thing. We were having fun.
Peter Wolf produced the new LP. I'm interested to know why you chose him to work with. He's worked with Starship, and I think the Jay Giles Band as well.
No, this is a mistake. People have confused. There's two Peter Wolfs.
Oh, right, okay.
The Peter Wolf that we work with is a classically trained pianist from Vienna. And he is the guy who worked with Starship as well. But he's just such a brilliant, off-the-wall genius musician that as soon as I met him, I immediately wanted to work with him. He's got a great attitude. He's a great enthusiast. He's very much like people that we've worked with in the past, like Steve Ollivant and like Robin Miller, in as much as that he's a great fan of music. He's interested in all different types of music and really gets into people and atmosphere, and he's a real great person to work with. Mm.
So, Mark, am I the first person to make that mistake of actually thinking it was the Peter Wolf?
We did a month of interviews in America, and everyone thought it was a Jay Giles Peter Wolf. It was a constant correction.
So how long ago were you in America? How many weeks ago? Months ago?
A month ago?
Yeah.
6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Listening to the LP, it sounds very much geared towards the American market. Was that deliberate on your part?
I don't think so. I mean, people have said this to us, and to be quite honest, it's actually the most live album we've ever done, you know. Mm. For the first time, we were actually playing very much as a band in the studio. Previously, what we would do, I would do a guide guitar, and then just do a version of the song just on guitar, and then Mark would lay the drums down and we'd build on that. But this time, Peter encouraged us to play very much as a band in the studio, you know. So, and I think it suits us to do that, you know, because it means that when we take the songs out to do live arrangements, it's very easy for us to communicate the songs properly. Plus, a lot of the material that we recorded this time, we had actually done live before we went to record it, which I think makes a big difference for us, you know. I think it makes the whole thing sound much more cohesive and much more expressive, and lets us keep the arrangements very simple.
We didn't
let the song
put as much
come
on overlays.
We certainly did much less overdubs because we did it live.
Did the sound of the album more come from Peter Wolf's natural favouring, that kind of sound, or did you sense that there were directions pushed down from the big suits?
No, I mean, it was definitely a Peter Wolf album, you know, definitely. I mean, there are songs, without a doubt, they are our big country songs, but it just sounded like it was recorded by another band that's not called Big Country.
That's perfect, because that's how I felt when I listened to it. I remember when I finally got to the track Peace in Our Time, I thought, okay, now this sounds like Big Country.
Yes.
I was so happy to hear those guitars again. But yeah, I got to say that I was disappointed at the time because I wanted, you know, I was such a fan of the earlier sounds. But I got to say, there's a lot of Peace in Our Time's production that I really like about it. I mean, even in hindsight. Yeah, I mean, there's an airiness to it that's really worked, I think.
I mean, I think it's one of Mark's favorite sounding albums.
Yeah.
Mark always says that's the best we've ever sounded. You know?
His drums sound great on it.
Yeah, and the actual overall sound of the album is brilliant. You cannot fault it.
Yep.
It's a great sounding record. But it's not Big Country.
Right, right. And Bruce, did that LA environment, is that what influenced your hairstyle at the time?
Possibly. I think apart from Stuart, I think everybody in the band had long hair. It just, I don't know if it was a sun thing or, you know, we didn't go to the barber shop often enough, but it definitely got a bit rock and roll around about that period.
Well, it's funny because there was a little record shop from my college where I was attending at the time, and I'll never forget. I knew the new Big Country album was coming out, and I used to walk up to this record shop. It was about a couple miles walk, and I would buy stuff and walk back to my dorm room. And I'll never forget opening up the Peace in Our Time sleeve and seeing that picture of you guys. And I just thought, what in the world has happened?
Welcome to America, boys.
That's right.
Yeah, and the same thing for me. When I was ripping up the tape, I bought it on tape first, and I saw the picture, and I thought, all right, you know, Bruce, we got some heavy metal there. Little did I know.
Yeah, that's right.
A heavy metal hairdo.
It looked good on you.
Mark had a serious mullet, and Tony had dreadlocks, I think, for that period.
Yeah.
Stu kept the sort of cool, you know, the mid-50s Elvis hairdo on that one, you know.
He looked like the guy from Aha in that sleeve, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know, Tony had dreadlocks and a T-shirt of him wearing dreadlocks.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I do believe Tony still has that T-shirt.
That was hilarious.
He wore that on a white.
Did he really? Oh, that's awesome. One last question for you I had about Peace in Our Time, Bruce, is you know, you guys have gotten a lot of flack for those backing singers live.
Oh man, I forgot about that.
And I'm wondering, yeah, because like I was talking to John about this on another time, and I thought the backing vocals that you guys had on the Skids reunion were absolutely perfect. I mean, it was just added so much to that. And I always thought that if you had had that style of backing vocals for the Peace in Our Time tour instead of the type that you had, it would have worked much better. I mean, what happened there? What was the reason for that, for those two?
Well, in the studio, we had the fantastic Mary Clayton came and did the backing vocals along with Ina Wolf, Peter's wife, and they did it on King of Emotion. Mary Clayton's great. She sung on Sympathy for the Devil, you know, the Stones.
Wow.
Great voice. And of course it was like, well, we're going to go out to Russia and all these places and do the album, you know, so we need to get the backing vocalists in. None of us knew any backing vocalists, so I think it was either the record company or the management to find a couple of backing vocals. But yeah, backing vocalists, and, you know, the girls turned up, and they were very rock and roll. I mean, we used to call them the Four Marys for obvious reasons. It was maybe just a bit too rock and roll, you know, kind of going, not heavy metal, but sort of turning into a normal sort of hard rock band, you know. And
yeah,
it got a bit cliched. So, I mean, those girls are great singers, there's no two ways about it.
I was going to say, they sounded great. It was, it, for me, it was more like the dance moves they were doing during Thousand Yard Stare or something like that. Just like,
oh, God, yeah. You know,
yeah.
Josh Phillips on keyboards, and I've heard some of the mixes from those that time, and it's just so keyboard heavy, and to the backing vocals, it kind of sounded like a normal, average rock band, you know, and it's not what we're about.
Well, you live and learn. It's an interesting period, that's for sure.
It certainly was.
Last thing on Peace in Our Time, Bruce, is what's your favorite track off that album?
Soft Spot, King of Emotion, the Thousand Yard Stare, I think I'll go with.
I love that choice. I love that choice. Beautiful song. Shot! Hey everyone, this is Tom cutting in here. We didn't get a chance to set this up when we were having the discussion with Bruce, but we're about to play an unreleased track from the REL sessions that we've just been talking about. This is an instrumental track. And it's never been released before on any compilation. There might be a couple people who have this, I'm not sure, but I'm sure that the vast majority of you have never heard this before. This was sent to us by Bruce himself. He gave his blessing for us to play this, and I think you'll really enjoy it. It's a very cool track, fantastic quality, so here we go. ¶¶
instrumental, if Stuart had did the lyrics on that, could have been on Peace in Our Time, because it was the same era, you know.
Well, I notice a lot of pieces from When a Drum Beats on that, like the bridge section from When a Drum Beats is in there, and there are a lot of segments that ended up on that song.
Yes, yeah, like, it was a kind of work in progress. It was kind of like when we did The Great Divide in Wonderland, that was could have ended up like that, but we split it in two, and Stuart used the Wonderland riff to go across my guitar. When I did the original demo for Wonderland, it was just Mark and I that was in the studio. But we had also did that kind of Great Divide instrumental. And then Stuart went, I can take the guitar part from that song and put it in one, and it worked.
Well, that's a theme to our podcast, so that
yes, no.
version. So yeah.
Yeah, you got Mark going 1, 2, 3, 4 at the start, and you take that from Fields of Fire.
I did indeed. Very good ear. Okay, so let's jump into the No Place Like Home era. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit with Mark leaving the band. I think that was kind of a surprise for fans when they saw that Pat Ahern was playing with you guys. So I know Pat was a friend of Tony's, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and I know he didn't quite work out with you guys, but you did some really, you know, some interesting stuff with him. Save Me, Heart of the World, and some tracks with Tim Palmer. Yeah. Yeah. Producing, and I always thought that Tim Palmer did a really nice job with you guys sound wise. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm just curious how you felt about that period between Peace in Our Time leading up to No Place Like Home. And
I had met Tim Palmer when we were out in LA doing Peace in Our Time, and I got on well with him and Chris Sheldon, who was his engineer, and I loved the stuff that Tim had did with Robert Plant. He did a couple of albums with him. Mm. And I really liked the sound of it. And we got in the studio, I think it was Livingston Studios down in London, and we did Heart of the World and Save Me. I was never a big fan of Save Me. I kind of just thought, kind of a bit like Look Away, sort of the same sort of rhythm, same tempo as Look Away.
Yeah.
Same time signature. I really liked Heart of the World. I thought that was really a great song, you know. And obviously Pat played on both of them. It was a kind of transition period. That was the period leading into the Greatest Hits album as well. But
right.
But I mean, if you go back to No Place Like Home, I mean, that was weird because Mark drummed on the album, but he came back as a session player. You know, we hired him as a session because Mark was obviously busy with Midge and Fish and, you know, it was like, well, we need somebody to play drums on this. And, you know, obviously Mark was available for that period of time. And it was like, well, let's get into Rockfield and do it with Mark. Who better to play drums on a big country album than Mark Buzicki?
I mean, as a musician, it's a great band to play in. It really is.
Now we have these...
Who said you were a musician, Mr. Drummer?
Well, I hang around with him. You know what I try and do.
Sorry, Mark.
And it was really weird because Mark turned up. It's the same old Mark. Great. But he was doing it as a session as opposed to being in the group.
did that color his playing on the album? Because he definitely has a more subdued sound on that album, but yet the whole band is a little more subdued on that album. So
it's a weird album. It sounds like four different bands playing on the one album. You've got tracks like Republican Party Reptile, which is real heavy duty stuff with the slide, heavy guitars. And you've got, oh God, give me some titles from that album, quick.
Dynamite Lady.
Dynamite Lady, which sounds unlike anything that we've ever done before.
I love that song, by the way.
Stuart's voice differs on a lot of tracks. It's like 1 minute he is kind of American sounding, and other times he goes back into the old Stuart voice. And I mean, there's just those tracks just sound so different. Like 70s rock. There's a couple of tracks on it that sounds like it was recorded in the 70s.
Yeah.
That was Pat Moran that produced that, and I love Pat Moran. I thought he was a great producer, and I thought Pat worked out great with us, great ideas. Sadly, he's no longer with us either, you know. He produced like Bill Nelson stuff as well, Pat.
That's right. And he did like Edie Brickell?
He did, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, Pat was brilliant. He just really focused, kind of old school producer, sort of like in the same vein as Chris Thomas. Very 70s sounding as well, but you know, I loved that. In fact, I think he did stuff with Robert Plant as well. In fact, he did. He did The Big Log, I think.
Oh, wow, okay.
I think Pat was involved with that. That's a terrible name for an album, eh? Big Log.
Okay, I just remember something from a country club magazine about drummers, that you actually were very close to hiring Simon Phillips for No Place Like Home, but you got Mark in the last second. Is that true?
No, it's completely untrue.
Okay.
Well, settles that.
I'm sure you're making this up, Spine. You're just going
I'm pulling it out of my arse.
Definitely not. No, okay. Not at that time. We obviously got Simon in later on for the Buffalo Skinners, but at that time, no, definitely not.
Well, it seems a little strange, but there you go.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Bruce, about that album, because what I always found interesting is that Through a Big Country came out, and that was the greatest hits album, and it was really successful for you guys. It seemed like it sold very well.
Yeah.
And then you came back with No Place Like Home, which was such a different sounding album from what people would expect from Big Country, especially after Peace in Our Time. I mean, was there a conscious effort to reinvent yourselves with that album, or did it just kind of the way it happened?
No, just kind of the way it happened. And again, it was a collection of songs. You know, it's like it was just the album was basically just a collection of songs.
Yeah.
And that was kind of it, you know. I mean, I think there's some really good songs on that album.
I do too. I think, you know, the aforementioned Dynamite Lady is one of the best tracks, I think, in the band's whole repertoire. I love that song.
Beautiful People, I think, is great. I kind of prefer the original demo for Beautiful People. It's not like I've got a case of demoitis, but there was something about the original demo. I mean, we changed it completely.
Yeah, and a lot of those demos are so different.
Yeah, I mean, the way we approached Beautiful People was kind of, I think we were listening to a lot of the band at the time as well, you know, and we kind of approached it as if we were, you know, the band, you know, Levon Helm, Robbie Robertson kind of thing, you know.
Right, right.
You mentioned it's a collection of songs like every album is, but... much like Peace in Our Time, I have to ask how much of the production is down to Pat and how much is down to record company interference, which there seems to be more of on this one.
Record company's got nothing to do with it. You know, they have nothing to do with that. They had an A&R. Again, another A&R guy came in. What's his name? Whatever his name was, I can't remember.
Best forgot.
And he came there. Again, I don't think he was... Russ Conway, he was called, actually. I know that's the name of a famous musician. This guy was called Russ Conway. Yeah, lovely guy. But again, I just don't think Big Country were high up in the list of his priorities.
Yeah.
So he came in and he made a few suggestions and we changed a few bits and bobs. But it's just, again, it's a collection of songs. That's all it is.
I remember Stewart saying at the time that he was really disappointed because he took Kansas and Ships to the record company, and he said they didn't even want them on the album. Like, he took the demos of those songs. I'm just wondering if that's something that kind of difficulty in getting what he thought were some of his best songs that he'd written in a while.
I don't know if that's true, because Stewart would never take songs to the record company. They were always done through the management. We'd send the tapes to the management, and the management would take them in, unless, of course, Ian took them in and the record label maybe said that, you know, it's not for him.
Okay.
But Ships and Kansas are great songs, and I've got the demos here in front of me, and they were recorded at House in the Wood Studio with Pat Moran playing drums on them.
Oh, and wow.
Really, not Pat Moran. Did I say Pat Moran? I mean Pat Hearn.
Okay, all right. That's good to say.
Pat Hearn playing drums in them. I feel like they were like just embryonic versions of the songs. It was the first draft. They were needing more work done to them, obviously. And I think the versions that we did on No Place Like Home are great. Obviously, we did Ships with just piano and a synthesized string quartet and Stuart's vocal, but we did a full band version of the song as well. I don't know if that ever saw the light of day. But when we, you know, skipping forward to the Buffalo Skinners, when we went back with Chris Briggs, he said, you know, they're like two missing songs. You've got to re-record those songs.
Mm.
And because Chris knew a good song is a good song. But at the time, Phonogram, they just didn't see it, you know?
Right.
But
right.
Songs, they were still at their early stages.
Right, exactly. Okay, that clears that up then. That's great. Okay, so favorite track off of this album?
Give me some tracks, for God's sake.
I'll give you the entire track listing. Let's see.
Okay.
Kansas, Republican Party Reptile, Dynamite Lady, Keep On Dreaming, Hostage Speaks, Leap of Faith.
Okay, I'm going to go with the Hostage Speaks. Willie's just passed me the list and I've got on his iPhone. I'm going to go for the Hostage Speaks.
I love that song.
Fantastic song.
I love Hostage Speaks because I'm playing an old Gretsch and we've got that corny sort of Roland drum machine at the start and then it kicks in with Mark's real drums. I just like the overall vibe of that song, you know, and it was also what was going on in the world at the time, you know.
And it still is too. It's still a very timely song.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that one.
Do you prefer the demo version of that over the album version, or how did you feel about that? The demo version was so much heavier.
Yeah, I don't know. I like the demo version very much. It's almost got a glam rock kind of feel. It's got a kind of T-Rex vibe. I've got a lot of finger picking and playing guitar with a plectrum on, I think, the whole of that album. I don't think I used a pick, I was just using my finger, I was just experimenting, you know. And I was getting into that kind of almost Dave Edmonds-y kind of, you know, pulling the strings and stuff. And that's what I did on the demo. And I kind of like that, you know.
The past 2 years, Big Country have been recording their new album, Buffalo Skinners. They've also had a change of label from Phonogram to Chrysalis. We're going to be chatting to the band today, right in the middle of their current tour, and finding out a little bit more.
We've been through a situation over the past couple of albums where people who were working with the group, the guys who signed us to the record company, had left, and we were trying to get a relationship going with other people. They had one idea of what Big Country should be, and we had a very different one. And I think when you're trying to start up a new relationship like that, you're quite willing to come and go with people. And it's only with hindsight I realise that any time I've let someone have that kind of involvement in the band, it's done is dilute our own personal vision of what it is that we want to do. We've always had a very strong idea of what we feel the band is about, what we feel we should be doing. And I think that with this record, we've been able to do that. You know, we've been able to simply go and make the record that we want to make and then hand it over to the record company, which I feel is how it should be. That's how we used to make records in the past. I'm a great traditionalist. I believe that all you should do is set up the microphones and record the performance. That's what I do. I like to record quickly and very spontaneously. And really, this record is the sound of that. It's pretty much representative of what the way we feel we are as a group. And we're highly delighted with it.
You've changed record company since the release of the last album now, from Phonogram to Chrysalis. What was the reasoning behind that?
It was shite.
they were garbage.
No.
I'll ask that question again.
What happened was I got to a point where they couldn't work with us and we couldn't work with them, and it was just stalemate, you know.
What, were they trying to have too much of an influence on how your records were going to sound? Or
yeah, well, the first two albums,
I don't know what they were trying to do.
The first two records kind of were hits on their own, you know, because we were a new band, a new attitude, and we did things slightly differently. But then it's almost like, in order for the record company to keep the success level up, they all of a sudden tried to take over and say, well, look, we know what you do best. You know, do it the way that we... But they didn't have a clue, to be honest. And it just went downhill from then. And, you know, we didn't lose interest, but the magic wasn't there for quite a few years. But signing to Compulsion Chrysalis has been a complete and utter rejuvenation. A lot of people out there won't understand that, but if you're working with people who respect what you do and want you to get on and do it yourself because they know that we could come out with the goods, then we feel a lot freer.
The midday sky was grey and purple, at least it wasn't blue.
So Buffalo Skinners, I mean, this was like an incredibly welcome return to form.
Yes, it's back to normal, guys. We're back, you know, thank goodness.
Exactly. I remember buying this CD. I had to drive an hour and a half to buy this because the only place I could buy big country CDs at the time here in America were in import shops.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a great one, but it was far away. So I drove an hour and a half to buy it, and I did not have a CD player in my car at the time, so I had to wait till I got home to listen to it. But I remember reading the lyrics in the car, and just the lyrics even struck me like, okay, Big Country is back. You know, I can tell by these lyrics.
Sorry.
No, no problem.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't like to be a passenger in your car, this. Read the lyrics.
No, I was parked when I read.
License and registration, Mr. Kirchhoff.
Uh-oh.
You're nicked.
Cue the cops theme song.
Bad boys, what you gonna do when they come for you?
What was it like to be reunited with Chris Briggs again, and what was the overall feeling with the band after you'd gone through, you know, a couple albums of, I guess, difficulties with the record company? Now you had someone who really believed in you again. And
yeah, it was just like the old days. We went down to Chrysalis Records and we saw Chris, and we did the demos at a place called Audiocraft in Dunfermline. Just the three of us, and Mark still wasn't there. Now that was a drum machine we used on the demos, which I've still got.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris loved the songs. And like I said, he said, like, you know, Kansas and Chips, forgotten songs, get them on the album. Obviously, Mark was out doing something with someone, and it was Chrissy's idea that we got Simon Phillips in, and it just worked out good. It's one of, even though Mark's not on it, I would say it's my second favorite Big Country album, I think.
I would put it right up there as well. And, you know, it's funny. It's hard for me to imagine, you know, rating a Big Country album so highly that doesn't feature, you know, the four of you, but yet I forget that Mark isn't even on it, because if there had to be someone to take his place, I can't imagine anyone better than Simon Phillips.
I think Mark would probably play the same thing. I think, you know, I mean, Simon and Mark are very, they're up there, you know. There's not many drummers in the UK that can touch those guys, you know. And I think Mark would have done exactly the same, apart from the Octoban start on What I Love. That was really weird. I mean, we could not get that in time. I mean, Simon came up with this groove thing, and none of us could find one. It's such a strange part, but it was really hypnotic and strange, but I love it. We sent Simon the demos with the drum machine, and he's such a busy man, you know. He turned up at the studio and he was setting up his kit, and he learned the songs that morning in his car, driving across London to get to the studio. That's wow. How good he is, you know.
Yeah, and one very interesting thing with the drummer scenario is that Mark went to Pete Townsend and Simon came from Pete Townsend. You basically just swapped drummers for that one.
Yeah, I mean, Mark was... Again, he was unavailable, you know. But towards the end there, you know, when Mark heard the album, he was like, I want my job back. let's have two guys. No, it's okay, but I've got Simon Phillips. Good. Oh, he's good. Right. Oh, come on back, you know, get in.
Well, that's kind of, I'm kind of jumping a little bit ahead to the tour of the Buffalo Skinners, but I was always interested, you know, how did Mark, was there kind of a little friendly competition type spirit there with Mark, because I'm sure that he was learning Simon Phillips' parts. He must have been thinking, you know, hey, I would have done this differently, or I'm gonna do this better than Simon. Or
no, Mark's not that kind of guy.
Okay.
I still think Mark would have played it pretty much like what Simon did. I mean, Simon would go in and do, you know, get his drum set up and do a take, and it'd be like, I think I've got it, you know.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We tried to have a song called it's on the demos. There's one that had a drum machine on it. It's East World. We tried East World with Simon.
Oh, you did? Oh, I would love to hear that.
It didn't work out. We had such a strict drum machine pattern where it was like almost a rolling snare thing. Mm. And we tried that with Simon, but we ended up, we kept the machine on it, which I think it ended up on one of the B-sides or where it is. It just did not work out.
Well, you know, we talked about that song on podcast, and Svein and I both agree that that's one song where the drum machine actually almost works better. You know,
it's part of the song. You know, the drum machine is such a syncopated part.
Yeah.
We tried it with Simon, but I needed that drum machine feel to make it work, you know.
Okay, I have to go back to the title track again, which is not on the album, so we have the same scenario as for The Crossing. Why didn't it make it this time?
Because it was a ballad, basically. We had Ships on it. Again, we'd recorded Ships, which was the almost like, you know, we'd always have a ballad on an album, like A Chance or whatever, and we had Ships on there. And the rest of the album was so heavy, we didn't think the Buffalo Skinners would have sat anywhere on that album, you know. I just wouldn't have sat right, and we just kept it back and used it as a B-side.
Yeah, great. It's a beautiful song, and the way that you guys redid it on the Eclectic tour was really gorgeous.
Yeah, again, it was one of those songs that we never explored as much as we should have done. It could have been in the set, you know, kind of like a Winter Sky kind of thing, you know. It's, you know, we should have played that song more, you know.
The one thing that was great about the Buffalo Skinners for us American fans is that you guys toured over here again, and I remember I saw you at the Bayou on Halloween night in 1993.
I remember that in Washington.
Yes, Washington, D.C. It was just a fantastic show, and it was packed. And
it was great. I remember walking there at Halloween, and it was like to be greeted by this woman dressed up as Catwoman, you know, the Michelle character.
That's right.
And a guy just walking down the stairs in full Clockwork Orange regalia, and he had it exactly like Malcolm McDowell in the movie, you know, the same shirt and the little cufflinks with the eyes on them and stuff. Absolutely amazing. One of my favourite times for a tour in the States. We were out in the States for a long, long time, and I loved it. It was great. Get on the tour bus again and watch World TV at the front window, you know.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I remember that night because Stuart came out and said, Happy Halloween. As you can see, we've come dressed as Big Country.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you launch into all Go Together, and it was just...
All Together was the opening number, that's right.
Hi, how are you all doing? We're called Big Country, and we're from all over the place.
Were you surprised at how well received that tour was? I mean, because you hadn't played in America for so long, and there were so many fans that were starving to see you guys back over here, and it, you know.
The tour was great because there was so much variety. I mean, that tour, you could be in New York and or New Jersey, you're playing at the Stone Pony, and then you go to another state and you're playing at Prince's Club, and then you go to another state and you're playing at a big open air festival, and then you're doing big huge gigs, and then you're doing really small gigs. And I just thought, this is great, because it made every day so much different, where you're not just going at the same venue every night. It becomes a bit like a residency. And we were also exploring the acoustic side of things as well.
Right.
Because we were going into radio stations during the day with acoustic guitars and, you know, just doing different acoustic versions of our songs. And there was one gig, I think it was Chicago or Detroit, I can't remember now, the power just failed completely. Everything, okay. The backline, the PA just went off, and it was like, oh, what are we going to do now? Oh, get the acoustic guitars out. And some of the songs we obviously knew, but some of it we were just making up as we went along. It was like a happy accident. It was really great, really cool.
I'm just jealous you got to see them on that tour.
I know. You know, I'm always hearing from the UK guys about, oh, I've seen Big Country 100 times. Or, I've seen you guys 3 times. So, you know, I'll take that. Well, Bruce, what's your favorite track off of Buffalo Skinners? I know that you had a heavy hand in a lot of these tunes, specifically Seven Waves, which is a great song. So what's your favorite?
I've got a, let me see, Soft Spot, definitely. Chester's Farm. Oh my God! I'm gonna go for the one I love.
Was that a cool moment playing that on the Tonight Show?
Oh, Jay Leno.
Yeah, Jay Leno show.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing doing it on the Jay Leno show. It's weird when you go over to the States, especially at that time. You know, you're obviously watching American TV shows like the late like Conan O'Brien show and.
Right.
You never saw anything like that in the UK, and obviously you're watching TV and you're seeing watching the Jay Leno show and that, and then, you know, a few months later you're actually on it.
Okay, so we move in now to Why the Long Face. We've got 2 more to go here. And Spine, I'll let you kick off the questioning for Why the Long Face.
Yeah. I just thought I'll just ask a nice round question. What was the general mood in the band at this time, following up from the Buffalo Skinners? Where were you sort of heading for? What was your goal with the album?
Well, the mood was great because Mark was back. We're back to being... Big Country as a 4-piece, you know, and camaraderie was there, and we all got on fine. It's my least favourite Big Country album, Why the Long Face. It's got some good songs on it, but again, you want to get better every time, and I just kind of thought the songs weren't there, you know. There's some good stuff, like I'm Not Ashamed, and I actually like Post Nuclear Thought and Blues. That's my favourite song on that album, only because it gives you a bit of relief. I mean, the whole album kind of sounds, it's two loud guitars, kind of very heavy sounding guitars, very over the top sounding compressed drums. I've not really got much to say about this album. I mean, it's got its moments. Thunder and Lightning, I like that. But not a big fan of that album, I'm afraid to say.
Well, what happened with you guys? I know you guys left Chris Briggs, or maybe he left the company at this time. But it seemed like you changed record companies as well, didn't you? You went to Castle Records.
Yeah, I mean, I know that for a fact that Chris got the demo sent to him, and he came back and just said that, nah, you know, you need to do more work, and maybe some of these songs you know, what he was looking for. And looking back, I think he was right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stuff on it like One in a Million. Great song, you know. But there was too much of that all, you know, that heavy, distorted sort of thing going on, you know. I think at that time as well, Stuart had moved to America. Possibly he'd moved to America beforehand, but it was the demos were kind of disjointed, you know. It's like everybody was living miles apart, and you know, it was always a hard getting everybody together, you know, logistically.
Yeah.
And when we were doing the demos, we could only, it was only done in a certain periods of time, you know, where maybe Stuart had told the following Monday they need to go back to America or whatever. And, you know, I just, like I say, it's not my favourite album.
Swine, anything else for this?
I don't have too much. I'll just say that I like the album. I think...
of course we do. We're big country fanatics.
Yeah. So I feel like I have to come to defense when anyone criticizes, even one of those who made it. So that's the toll of a fan. But no, but it's a very interesting time in big country because a lot seemed to be happening sort of behind the stage, you know, with Stuart obviously moving to the U.S. and... the market being very strange in the 90s. I see far bigger bands than Big Country really struggle to find their place and their niche in the market.
Sorry, something happened there.
It's always fun in the Watson household.
The Soviets were cutting into our line.
Yeah.
Can I break in here? Just for maybe, I don't know whether it's something you might may or may not want to discuss. Just my own little bit about the... Why the Long Face era. It seemed to be kind of the one time where they kind of drifted off, not drifted off, well, they just kind of started to do a lot of covers during that period.
That's true, yeah.
You know, yeah, so I don't know whether that's something you want to talk about or not. Back to the Wall.
Interesting. No, that's good.
I think we got a bit bored with being Big Country and wanted to have some fun and go and do cover versions of Daydream Believer and stuff, just for fun, just because we could.
I was saying when the Soviets invaded was basically that far bigger bands than Big Country were struggling in the 90s to find their niche in the marketplace. It was really strange, and fashions changed almost overnight, first with grunge, and then grunge even left, and what was left, and how did you guys cope with that?
How did we cope with that? I mean, different bands coming and going, you mean?
The markets change, and then basically the fashions change, and I guess because it wasn't about fashion anyway, but...
I think we kind of became like, I don't know, what people thought status quo had become, you know, a Uriah Heep or something, you know, it's just like old hat kind of thing, you know. And again, I think if we had, after the Buffalo Skinners, if we had maybe left it for a while and disbanded maybe for a year or so and got back, but because we did have a bit of success with the Buffalo Skinners, obviously people want you to do the next thing and they want it quick. And I just think we didn't push ourselves enough to come up with better material for that album. Yeah. I think it's hard, to me, it's half an album. You've got some great stuff like I'm Not Ashamed on there, you know, fantastic song. But you've got other stuff like Charlotte, which it's not really, you know, it's just a kind of jam sort of thing, you know.
The one thing I'll say in Charlotte's defense is that I really loved the guitar break in the middle of that song. It always reminded me of, in fact, I told Stuart this in Nashville once when I spoke to him. It always reminded me of almost like it had an Angle Park type of feel, if you can believe that. Like, that first guitar break where it's like.
Yeah.
I always loved that. It was a cool little nod to the past. But
yeah. And then there's other stuff like Blue and a Green Planet, which, again, the original demo was kind of interesting, and then the way we approached it, it kind of reminded me of that psychedelic first song, you know.
right.
It's, you know, I just a bit throwaway.
When you guys were with Chris during Buffalo Skinners, was that just like did that deal end after Buffalo Skinners and you were trying to find you then ended up with Castle and Chris decided not to pick you guys up again? Or
I think it was only a two album deal. I think we had we did obviously the Buffalo Skinners, and then there was was it Safety Net, the live album?
Yes. Okay.
That was on Compulsion as well. And I think it was just a two album deal. Chris had probably the option to go for another one. But it wasn't for him. I mean, he heard the demos that we did at House in the Woods, and he really just said it's not for him.
Okay.
He was wanting us to develop the songs further, but we didn't. So there you go.
Gotcha. Now that makes total sense.
I have a last one.
Yeah, go ahead, Svein.
Yeah, just my final one, and it's sort of contradicting John's input earlier. This is about B-sides. On one of the You Dreamer CD singles, you have a trio of B-sides, Ice Cream Smile, Magic in Your Eyes, Bianca, which are more folksy and more Nashvillian, and quite a big change for the band, but very likable songs.
I love those songs. Those were recorded up in Scotland, and I love those songs. They're really, again, not something you'd expect Big Country to come out with. Mark really got into the arrangements of these songs as well, especially with the vocals. Kind of entry. Again, don't sound like Big Country, but they're good fun to play. I love those songs.
So the band was quite positive to moving more towards, I guess what most people assumed, Stuart brought this from Nashville and brought it to Big Country and had you guys play on his songs. But that's not the case.
What song was that, sorry?
Still talking about Ice Cream Smile, Magic in Your Eyes, and those kind of small country-ish almost songs.
No, those were kind of... From memory, I just think we got in the studio and it was like, right, let's do something, you know. I don't think they were written by one specific person. I think.
All right, cool.
It was the four of us in the studio.
How how do you rate the Driving to Damascus album, Bruce? I mean, is that something that you feel really good about? I know it's it's the last album, so obviously there's kind of a sadness to it as far as it being the last album with Stewart. And if you look at the lyrics, you can kind of sense a lot of the issues that he was going through. But
those lyrics are in black and white. There's no getting away from what he was going through. Whereas in the early days, Stewart always said his lyrics were open to interpretation. But when you listen to somebody else and some of those lyrics, it's what's going on and what went down. It's laid there in front of you.
We were talking about some of even the B-sides in the past, like a song called Living by Memory. And it's almost one of the one thing about, a lot of big country songs is that there always seem to be a little spark of hope, even in the darkest songs. And in some of these songs, it seemed like that spark was even gone. It was just like all darkness.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on at the time, stuff like that Stuart was writing in Nashville. I don't know if some of those he co-wrote well or people, but there was a lot of we did a lot of the demos out in Nashville. Mark and I used to go and see Stuart quite a bit. That's where we banged into you. Was it the Sutlery gig we did there when we saw you?
Yes, that was a Sutler gig, yep.
Yeah, Sutler. exactly. So I think we did about four journeys out there. Tony came out once and got arrested.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Forgot about that.
But see, he goes, I'm not going back to Nashville ever again in my life. And he was completely innocent. I must have, he just kind of looked like a felon,
Was he wearing his Tony Butler Dredge T-shirt?
No, he was wearing the hat, and that was the giveaway, because the guy that was holding up the gas stations was wearing a hat very similar to Tony's.
Oh my!
And the cops should have just arrested the hat, If I'd be asking the cop to the hat from then on,
Are you listening to that, John? You take some notes there.
I'll take the fifth on that one.
I keep forgetting I've got a cop in here. I'm glad that you're not watching this on video. I'm not going to tell you what we're up to this morning time.
Well, he might be. He might be. You never know.
Okay, only is put your clothes back on.
Installed these secret cameras last weekend, didn't you?
It's so hot in here with that fire, really. I mean, let's at least put our pants on.
at least the pants, yes, at least.
So we're talking about Damascus.
Yes, and some of these B-sides, you've got the age-old question with all big country releases. I mean, you've got so many fans who say, why didn't this make the album? Why didn't that make the album? So I'll join in the chorus for a particular song, and that is Loserville. I love the long version of Loserville that you guys used to play before you kind of snipped it down in the studio.
Right.
Was that just a tune that was one of those casualties because of its length and didn't really know what to do with it?
No, again, it was one that we thought would sit right on the rest of the album. When you do an album, you want a bit of continuity there.
Right.
Which we never always achieved that. But on certain albums, Damascus is one of them, like Buffalo Skinners, there was a certain flow to the way the songs ran into each other. And if you stuck something like Loserville in there, it's just maybe a bit jarring for the listener, I think. And it's always good to keep these tracks back for different formats and stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm interested in the Ray Davis connection. How did you start hooking up with him?
Stuart got hooked up with Ray Davis in Nashville. And they wrote three songs together, which was Devil in the Eye, and
somebody else,
and there was a third song as well, the name escapes me, but I never saw the light of day. And we went into Conk Studios in London, Ray's place, and we demoed a few of the songs there as well.
The last thing that I would have about the Driving to Damascus period, because I know we've kept you here long enough, but I have to ask you about the whole Fragile thing fiasco with the single not charting and not being considered. Was that something that really it hurt you guys? I mean, or is that something that's been blown out of proportion with its?
No, I mean, it's a great song, Fragile Thing.
It sure is.
And it was at the time when Ian Grant was still the manager, but he put track records together, he bought track records, and he became the publisher, the manager, the record label, which is a complete conflict of interest anyway.
Yeah.
But he went out and got the packaging done and stuff like that. And to me, it looked like a bloody pizza box, this thing, you know. It was, it was like something a child in school would do with origami, you know. It's like the box popped up, and I think then the powers that be said, oh, it's too much of a gimmick, there's too many folds in the packaging, it's going to entice people to buy it. And like, you know, they'll only buy it if they like it, you know, because of the box that it's in.
Right. Exactly.
You know, we knew that we could get airplay. Radio 2, which was the big station, it took over from Radio 1, and the people that were working with us from that side of the business were, you know, this will definitely get airplay and stuff like that, you know, but it ended up getting banned, or not banned, but it got sales got knocked off it or whatever because of the packaging, which we thought was just kind of petty.
Right. Yeah, I always thought that too. It just seems so nuts. I mean, if you don't like the band and don't like the song, a piece of packaging is not going to entice you to buy anything.
So. I mean, it's not as if you're slipping in $20 bills in it or something. Like
that. Right. I would have bought that single if it had come in, you know, a piece of Saran wrap. So, you know, it didn't make any difference to me. But well, Swan, anything else you have on Driving to Damascus? I know we're kind of giving it the short shrift here.
But I think we're approaching the end of the road there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Bruce, what's your favorite track from Driving to Damascus?
Perfect World, I'm going to go for this one.
What I'm looking for is a perfect world, one that I can share with my perfect girl.
Bruce, we can't thank you enough for doing this. I mean, you know, we had big plans, and we had like, well, maybe we'll get him on for an hour or two and at most, and we'll try to shoot as many questions as we can at him. And he'll never want to talk about every album in succession. So
I did this yesterday. I was at the BBC, and we really took me across the BBC, and I had to do a similar kind of interview with a guy called Phil Cunningham.
Okay.
And we were there for a long time, so that was like the warm-up for this one, you know?
So we kept you longer than he did.
It's been great.
Good.
It's great that you guys are taking time out to, I mean, you know more about it than what I do, you know?
I doubt that.
It's like archivists, you know? You know a hell of a lot.
We are.
It's great that you're keeping the Big Country name alive, you know?
Well, thank you. I mean,
it's funny you should say that, Bruce, because I think in one of the prior podcasts, I kind of mentioned that one of the conventions that you joined along in the Quizmaster and Gordon had beat you.
Yeah.
That's funny.
I mean, Gordon's another man. He's got a lot of stuff as well, you know. It's just amazing what you can – I mean, a lot of stuff I can't remember, you know. I remember all the early days like it was yesterday because it was new to me. And then you get to a certain level – and it all blurs into one, and then the later days you tend to remember. But there's that middle area that I'm a wee bit forgetful of, you know.
You think there'll ever be a book, Bruce? Do you have any interest in a book, or is that something?
Yeah, I think it'd be great to have a book out there, you know. And I've got a person that lives locally that
he's
probably
called.
Oh, he's just called. I've got a person here that'd be the perfect guy to do it, you know.
Fantastic.
But yeah, I think A Certain Chemistry, the book that came out, that was probably too early in our careers to bring a book out, you know.
Right.
You know, there's people nowadays that have been on The X Factor for 10 minutes and they've got their autobiography out there, you know.
A Certain Chemistry was great, though, especially in the pre-internet days when you were starving for information about you know, your favorite bands. And I certainly enjoyed that quite a bit and still do. So, well, I mean, Bruce, we just want to, you know, the reason that we are such fanatics as we are, and if you indulge me to be just a little bit melodramatic here for a minute, I mean, is because the music that you have been a part of creating has meant a huge amount to us and to our lives and to the people who listen to this. And
yeah, so, I mean, as well.
I know exactly. And yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, what you've done and your part in creating this music has really made a difference in people's lives. And it's very appreciated. And what you're doing now is even more appreciated. And the name that, you know, keeping Big Country going is fantastic. And We are firmly behind it, and we're proud to do our part to keep it going.
Yeah, I'm really super excited. Really super excited.
That's great. I mean, we could have changed the name if we wanted to, you know, but it's, you know, what's the point in doing that?
No.
Country, you know, it's, we could have changed it to Angle Park or something like that, but, you know, it's, nobody's heard of it.
Exactly. And you guys have spent your lives building that name up, and yeah, you deserve to use the name, and everyone in the band, I think, has got some connection to the band from the past. So, I mean, it works out beautifully.
Like I said, it's not a bunch of session musicians, you know, it's got to be the right people. You know, when Tony announced his retirement, it was like, again, it was like, well, what are we going to do next, you know? And Derek just, everybody, apart from Mark had never really met Derek, but Mike and I knew Derek, and Jamie knew Derek, and like I said, he's my twin, whether he's the evil twin or the good twin, I don't know, but, definitely works with Derek.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, the last question I have for you is, you said that Buffalo Skinners was probably your second favorite. Just curious what your first favorite album is.
Oh, The Crossing, without a doubt.
That's what I would figure. Great.
Because it was new to me at the time, you know. It was, I mean, I'd done the album once with Chris Thomas, and that got aborted. But, you know, the first time it happens, you know, to me, it's, I remember every minute of it, you know.
Well, Bruce, we're going to let you go.
So soon?
He's never going to want to come back now.
No, I know.
But I hope maybe we can do this again once the album is out.
Yeah, we'll definitely do it again. I mean, how many more podcasts are you going to do? Is this the last one for a while?
We have no limit. We tend to do one about every month.
So we
come up with different topics. You know,
so you got a few months worth in the can now.
We got a couple months worth. Well, hey, you guys have a great weekend.
Okay, that was great fun, guys. I really enjoyed that.
Great weekend.
Thank you.
It's almost over over there.
That's right.
It's now completely dark outside.
Well, we get to set the clocks back this weekend, so I've got an extra hour. I'll be in touch. Thanks, Bruce, and best to you and everyone else. And you too, Willie and John. Talk to you soon.
Alrighty then.
Okay, so that's it. Episode 12, the final part of our Bruce Watson trilogy. Wow, what a great series this has been for all of us, and just as fans. I mean, we've enjoyed listening to it, hopefully as much as you have. I mean, I really loved just listening to this and hearing Bruce talk about these things that I had not known before. Hopefully a lot of new information was presented here to most of you. So thanks again to Bruce for all the time he took to do this. I mean, you know, what can you say? Just an incredible guy, incredible generosity of his time to do this for us, and we really appreciate it. Thanks to Sandra, Jamie, everyone else who helped make this happen, Willie Welder, and of course to John Gouveia, the great John Gouveia, who hosts these podcasts on his page and is incredibly helpful and just a great contributor to this podcast behind the scenes and occasionally on the air. And he'll be on with us at future shows too. So thanks to you, John. And if you want to give us some feedback, send us an email to bigcountrypodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit us on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook, search for The Great Divide, Big Country Podcast. And you can also visit the website of the podcast at bigcountrypodcast.com. And finally, we are also now available on iTunes, which is huge for us. So if you want to listen to this through iTunes, just go to iTunes, go to podcasts, and search for The Great Divide, Big Country Podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and hope we all have a great 2013. And let's all hope the Mayans were wrong. I'm saying that they are right now. And we'll be back in 2013. We'll be back with episode 13 soon, and don't know what it will be yet, but hopefully some more surprises will be coming, and it looks like it's shaping up to be a great year for Big Country. So thanks again. We'll talk to you soon, and hope you enjoyed this trilogy. Take care.
Ollie has put your clothes back on.
Let's at least put our pants on.